We'll wait for maybe a couple more minutes to see if maybe a few more people show up. Okay, everyone, let's get started. What I'm going to talk about today is congestion control, both in a general sense and also in the context of TCP, which we have looked at last time. So it also completes some of the discussion about reliable data transfer and flow control in the context of TCP. So there were some missing pieces probably you haven't noticed, but you know, unless we talk about the congestion control aspect, TCP discussion is not complete. Okay. So the problem of congestion arises because there is a resource which is scarce and it needs to be shared among one or more communicating entities. So this resource typically in the context of a network is either your buffer at a particular router or switch, or the link capacity itself. Okay, and you know that is at the simplest level. But I think when you look at a composition of all of these, then it becomes a bit more complex type of a resource where you have a network of links with buffers. All of that make up the network level resource, okay. And that needs to be shared. Now, one way of looking at it is whenever the resource is in shortage, you over-provision to get around it. So that's one way of controlling congestion. Okay? Oftentimes, there is a debate about whether we should throw more resource at the problem or more money at the problem, because typically more resource means more money. Okay? And even among people who are experts in networking, they sometimes feel that the complexity associated with congestion control mechanisms is not worth it. Okay? Because oftentimes in the real world, simple approaches tend to fly quite well because you know they're more robust, they can be implemented well and all that. So you have to keep that in the back of your mind. You can always put more resource to alleviate the problem. But in a way, that comes at a cost. So what we want to be able to do is we want to allocate the resource in such a way that the congestion can be avoided. So that's one thing we could do. And also, we need to ensure fairness as well. Typically, whenever there is a shortage in resource, there is a contention among multiple entities wanting to use that resource. So you could favor a small subset of users at the expense of others, and that is an unfair allocation. So fairness and congestion go hand in hand. So the constraint of fairness is often something that makes congestion control more interesting, technically also more challenging as well. So that's something to bear in mind. And the other thing to keep in mind is queuing, something that we looked at the outset in terms of queuing delay and queuing theory. That is also closely tied to congestion. So when you have congestion, typically your queues build up, and that causes enormous amount of delay, and you would want to minimize that because the growth of the queuing delay can dominate even transcontinental link propagation delay. So very soon, because in a way, the nature of it is it grows exponentially. Okay, so queuing delays and queuing theory is something that is also relevant when talking about congestion. So that's sort of a broad view of putting congestion in terms of a big picture. Okay. Now, what happens when congestion what are the result or negative effects of congestion? Obviously, delay is one, but you also have losses because, you know, typically in the real world, the buffers or the queues are finite size, which means that at some point you start dropping packets. And that needs to be recovered. And in doing so, you might actually inject more traffic when you actually should be stopping. And that causes even further losses because, you know, you're trying to wastefully use the available resource. So in a way, you can get into a negative spiral, as we'll see with a few examples to start with. But primarily, the impact from a user perspective is higher delays and more losses when congestion happens. So that needs to be reduced. Okay. So let's see with a few examples some of the negative effects of congestion. So here's a toy example where you have two hosts trying to send to different destinations, but they share a common bottleneck router and a link. Okay, and this link has a capacity capital C. Okay, and assume that the buffer here is infinite, and since it is infinite, the fairness is not relevant because that resource is something that does not cause fairness. Whenever there is a finite resource, we need to worry about fairness. So basically, fair sharing of this buffer is not such a big issue, but fair sharing of the link is assumed here. Okay. So let's see what happens in terms of both the throughput or in some terminology, people use goodput as a way to indicate the amount of data that got successfully delivered at the destination point, which is basically denoted by lambda out. Okay, so that's referred to as goodput, and lambda in is the offered load in terms of how much data that you're putting in into the network from each host. So let's see how these two relate and also how the delay behaves. So since the buffer is infinite and this is the only bottleneck link on the path, we need to only pay attention to this. So this is something goes back to our discussion about throughput. So when we're talking about throughput, we only worried about the bottleneck link, right? So based on that argument, if we just look at this, here there is no question of dropping packets at all because, you know, we have an infinite buffer. We just take in packets, how many ever they come in. It's just that they take longer to get out, okay? So because of that, the number of packets that reach the destination is the same as the one that you inject into the network. So pretty much the good put is the same as the offered load. So this is obvious. And the other part, the delay, it's again something that can be explained using queuing theory, where the delay grows at an exponential level as you reach to the capacity of the link. And your share of the capacity is C over half or C over 2. And that when you, whenever the lambda sub n reaches that level, you know, you have an infinite delay. So this is sort of the base case. Now let's try and relax this assumption that the buffer is infinite. So let's go to the scenario which is a bit more realistic, where we have finite buffer. And here we need to make an assumption, just for simplicity, because you know we're not trying to address fairness in any explicit way. We just sort of say that, you know, we have some way of ensuring that the buffer is fairly shared. So link is fairly shared, the finite buffer is fairly shared. Now comes the question of the relationship between the lambda sub in prime and lambda sub out. This one not only includes the original data or the offered load, but also the data that is retransmitted, okay? Because now there is a possibility that the packets can get lost. So therefore, we have to recover from that and we have to retransmit. So that is an additional load on the network. So that's something that we have to consider. And we have to look at the relationship between these two. Now, the relation between these two very much depends on how and when you retransmit. Okay, if I retransmit when there is only space in the buffer, or if I transmit to start with, forget about retransmission. Some omniscient entity which tells me that there is room in the buffer, so I can afford to send, then there is no loss. Okay, so that scenario pretty much degenerates to what we had before. It's just that now we take assistance from an omniscient entity, we sort of back off from sending whenever there is no room in the buffer. Okay. So the delay doesn't grow up at an exponential rate, because you know, we're just trying to do some sort of throttling of the sender rate. But the relationship between the offered load and the good put is like before. Now, clearly this is not realistic. Let's go to another scenario where you send without having this assistance, but here in this case, you try and resend when the packet is known to be lost. So basically, you sent a packet before, and it got dropped because it reached a full queue. So that event is somehow made known to the sender. And only in those circumstances the sender sends, okay? And not in a premature way where it is timing out and then it tries to send because it is unsure whether the packet got through or not, okay? So in a way, this is also a bit idealistic, but compared to the previous case, a bit more realistic. So in this case, the I think let's pay attention to just this plot. Here, the good put still reaches R sub 2 for each sender, but there is some additional load in terms of retransmissions that we have to incur, okay? Because this lambda sub n is the sum of the original data plus retransmitted data. In the previous case, we didn't have to retransmit because you know we already knew whenever there was room in the buffer, and then only then we sent. Here we have to send, but we are sending only packets which actually got lost. So therefore, the amount of retransmission is somehow limited, and eventually, because you are not wastefully retransmitting and you will be able to have good put reaching R over 2 eventually. Okay. Now, the most realistic case is you don't even have this information in hand. You send whenever you're send-aside timer expires. And in that case, obviously, you have the possibility of duplicates, okay? So you may never reach this point where each sender may not get a good put of R over 2 ever, because you have a scenario where duplicates consume some of the bandwidth, okay? So that's basically what we are seeing here is, to start with, we've seen that delay is going to increase. Here also delay is going to increase because there is queuing happening, but there is finite queue, so basically the extent to which the delay can increase is bounded with a finite queue. And on top of it, when losses happen, in trying to recover for these losses, you wastefully use some of the network bandwidth. So that is the implication here. So whatever is the difference between these two is capacity that is lost. Okay, so there is no way to make use of that for user traffic because of the reality of how things can be realized in practice. So that is one of the things to keep in mind. And this is, of course, in a scenario where you had two flows trying to share one bottleneck link. This scenario is somewhat concocted where you somehow orchestrated that there is only one bottleneck link. But in reality, it could be much more complex, something like this, where you have a number of hosts talking to each other. So basically, host A talking to this particular destination, host B talking to this particular destination, and this particular destination talking to the host B, and so forth. So basically, all of these lines that are shown here in different colors correspond to different flows in the network. And in this case, you don't have just one bottleneck, but many bottlenecks here, okay? And many bottlenecks in many directions. So basically, each link or each router in both directions, it can be a bottleneck in this type of scenario. Now, what could happen here? What would be the relationship between the lambda sub n prime and lambda out for an arbitrary sender? It would be worse than what we have seen before, where there is potential for even more further drop in good put, because you not only have duplicates coming from the sender and consuming some bandwidth, but also the capacity that is consumed by packets that are eventually dropped. So on a path here, for instance, if you take focus on the red path, it could be that the packet came all the way here and got dropped at this point, okay? It could be the original packet, or it could be the retransmission packet, and the retransmission could be the duplicate or a proper retransmission. If it gets dropped at a later stage, all the capacity that it used till this point is wasted, okay? So in a way, each flow doing this to the other means that the lambda sub n prime it grows much faster, and you, from the lambda sub out or the good put point of view, you take a further drop. So if you go to this picture again, this sort of becomes a little bit like this, where more of the capacity is used for wasteful transmissions, where you're trying to transmit, but then at some point before reaching the destination, the packets are getting dropped. So therefore, from a sender's perspective, the lambda sub out never reaches its fair share of the capacity. Okay, so that's sort of a more serious manifestation of what we have seen earlier with a two flow scenario. Okay, so This is the scenario that we want to really avoid when we are designing a network. This is called the congestion collapse. Okay. So when you reach a particular level of an offered load includes both the original transmissions and the retransmission, you do not want the good put to good drop to zero. And this could happen because everything that is being sent into the network is getting dropped, and therefore you're trying to send more retransmissions, and those are making things worse and so forth. So basically, if you keep doing that, there is no original data that gets out of the network. Okay, it's just retransmissions that sort of clog the bandwidth, and ultimately you don't have a zero good put. Okay, so avoiding this situation is important, and we'll see how TCP gets around this. So basically, TCP also is subject to all of these real effects, but it also doesn't have any in-network knowledge, like some of the earlier examples that we have seen. It doesn't have any assistance of a global entity. So it needs to be able to infer what's happening in the network and get around this, and we'll see how it does that in a moment. Okay, so that's basically a little bit about what happens when congestion occurs. Like I said, broadly, you have losses happening, you have delay increasing, but the amount of losses can be so high that you may not have any real data getting out of the network. Now, how do you get around it? There are broadly two approaches. One is the end-to-end congestion control approach, and the other is network-assisted approach. The end-to-end approach is about only using the receiver and whatever you see at the sender side. Okay, receiver can assist you in trying to estimate the delay. For instance, you can estimate the RTT like we have been doing in the case of TCP, and that could be used as a way to infer congestion. In fact, there is a version of TCP called TCP Vegas, which tries to depend on this idea. Or you could use losses. Already we have seen that TCP reacts to the timeout, and also it reacts to the receipt of three duplicate acknowledge bits. Okay. In both those cases, it tries to retransmit. But it also can use those events to try and throttle the sending rate. Okay. So these, in a way, TCP is the canonical example when we're talking about end-to-end congestion control. But end-to-end congestion control is by default imprecise, and because you know it doesn't use the actual network information, it is always trying to infer. So what you estimate is always different from the reality. However good the estimate is, it is never the same as the actual reality. So therefore, that imprecision costs you something. And one way to get around it, obviously, is to take the network as your partner and help it, have it help you in trying to recover from congestion. And this can happen at a very crude level in a binary form, where the network can tell you that there is congestion or there is no congestion. And it is almost like TCP using loss as an indicator, but this is a bit more precise because it is coming from the network. Sometimes when a loss happens, it may not actually be because of congestion. So in a wireless network scenario, oftentimes the loss happens because you have unreliable links. It is not because there is congestion. So loss at the sender side is a bit unreliable indicator. But when the network tells you that there is congestion, you can, of course, use that as a cue to throttle the sending rate. On the other hand, the network can exactly tell you how much rate you should be sending at. It can sort of do a bit more work for you in determining the actual rate that you should drop yourself to. And that can be even more powerful in trying to relieve congestion. But of course, you know, this increases the complexity in the, inside the network. So in terms of the design of transport layer protocols and even applications, we've seen that we don't really touch any of the network core. In fact, none of the transport layer and application layer functions in the internet context involve changing the routers and switches in the core. Okay. It's only limited to end systems. So basically, that is the trade-off. You now want to change every router and switch on the internet in order to get this additional benefit. And that may be impossible. Just as you probably are aware, running out of addresses in the internet with the previous version or the current version that is used, IPv4. So transitioning to IPv6 has been a huge problem because every router and switch needs to be transitioned to using the new protocol. And that didn't happen. That's an even bigger problem because, you know, in some ways, at some point when you don't have addresses, you cannot let in new users into the system. So it can be difficult to realize. But this binary feedback, this binary feedback or the single bit feedback from the network has been implemented to some extent in systems. It's sort of, since it is a very minor change, it got into many of the implementations. So it is available, but it is not often used. Oftentimes, TCP is the main, the vanilla TCP is the main transport protocol that is used, and it doesn't use any kind of network feedback. Okay. So before talking about TCP, let's see a bit more into this in terms of how that can be implemented. Okay. So both the binary information and also the information about the explicit rate that the sender should be using from the network's perspective. So how those can be are implemented, for example, in a specific context in real life. I mean, I think there are scenarios where this is implemented. The single bit thing I said is this explicit congestion notification bit that is implemented but not often used, like I said. The ATM case is what we will see. It is something which has features to give feedback from the network for congestion control. So ATM has different classes of traffic that it can handle. One of the classes is called the available bitrate. So the available bitrate is very much like best effort traffic in the internet, where you know there is no with the internet, the best effort traffic doesn't get any guarantees in terms of loss or bandwidth from the network, and you only get reliability if you're using TCP. Okay, so that's what best effort traffic is. So available bitrate, it's a bit like that, where you try to use as much as you can get, but also it lower bounds the amount that you should get. So basically, there is a certain amount of minimum guaranteed rate that you will be given, and on top of that, pretty much you can be greedy. Okay, so that's what is available bitrate. So in the context of this, the congestion control mechanisms are implemented, the network-based congestion control mechanisms. And these are very much dependent on what are called the resource management cells. So in ATM context, everything is a cell. So you have a data cell and you have a resource management cell. So the traffic is sent in this 48-byte short messages, and this typically sits under the network layer. Okay, so it's like a little bit in link layer, a little bit network layer type of a technology. Okay, so this is typically used to be the case, used in the core of the internet before fiber came along, and in a way, it's sort of a common network core technology in the past. So in this context, these cells can carry information back to the sender to tell it how it should behave in terms of trying to throttle its rate, because you know we are not limiting ourselves to the guaranteed minimum rate, but we are trying to get greedy whenever you feel that you know there is more room in the network. So you need some feedback as well to sort of cut down on that. And these resource management cells with some specific bits allow you to do that. So one bit is the congestion indicator bit, which is indicating that there is actually congestion the sender needs to throttle. And the other bit is indicating when congestion is about to happen. Okay, not yet happened, but about to happen, and in that case, the sender should be staying away from increasing the rate. Okay, so these are two bits that these resource management cells carry. In addition to this, they also have something called explicit rate, which is a two-byte field, which indicates to the sender what rate it should be using. Okay, so this may or may not be used by the sender, but this is something that the network is providing to the sender. Okay, and so those fields are about the resource management cells. There are also the data cells, which could be marked. Okay, so let's see in the context of this example where you have switches, the ATM switches, and the source and the destination. These white cells are the data cells, and the red ones are the resource management cells. So white cells, if they reach a congested switch, okay, what the switch could do is mark the data cell with a bit turned on called explicit forward congestion indication bit. And when it reaches the destination, this data cell, when it reaches the destination can use the next incoming resource management cell to use this EFCI bit to turn on the congestion indication bit in the resource management cell. Okay, and the resource management cells, unlike the data cells, they are sent back to the sender. So basically, these red ones, they're coming back, as you can see here. So in a way, the destination, whatever it sets, or whatever the... So in a way, just to go back again, so the resource management cell bits can be set by every congested switch on the path or the destination. And when the destination sets this, it is because a previous data cell indicated that there was congestion. Okay, so in a way, you could have in this bit set at number of places on the path, but this information in a way is aggregated. This is not overridden, where if someone else sets this, you don't override it by trying to reset it. You just add it. In a way, if it is already set, you leave it set. If it is not set, you keep set it, and so forth. So that when that information flows back to the source, it can take the appropriate corrective measure. Okay, so that's the idea about ATM available bitrate service, which implements the network-based feedback condition control. So that said, let's look at the other way, which is end-to-end approach, and TCP, like I said, is a canonical example for this. So the TCP approach is, in a way, a blind man's approach. Okay, so you do not know what actually is happening in the network. So pretty much it's a black box. All you know is whether a loss has happened as far as you're concerned, because you're setting the timers to determine when to retransmit. And if you don't receive anything from this receiver in that time, then you conclude that a loss has happened. Whether actually a loss has happened is a different matter. You don't really care, actually, in the case of TCP. You assume that there is a loss. And similarly, when you receive three duplicate acknowledgments, you also assume that there is loss. And these loss events are used as a cue to conclude that there is congestion. Okay. And depending on the loss event, the throttling mechanism is different. So this picture is classical TCP behavior in the steady state. Okay. What that means is when you have no dynamism in this number of flows that enter the network. For instance, if you have a certain number of flows which are going for a long time, maybe 10 flows that are doing file transfers for 10 minutes, the initial period can be a little bit transient, because there is a mechanism called slow start and all that, which I'll talk about in a minute. But after a point, TCP reaches a state where it is just trying to probe how much bandwidth it can get, and it tries to get to the tip of that, and then a loss event happens with the three duplicate acknowledgement mechanism that it detects, and then it throttles a little bit, and then tries to probe again. Okay, so this probing and getting throttled keeps on going. So therefore, what you're seeing here is this sawtooth waveform. Essentially, your congestion window gets to this point, and then you cut it by half, and then you again trying to linearly reach, increase the congestion window, and then getting cut by half, and so forth. So basically, this keeps on going, and this cutting down by half is a multiplicative decrease mechanism. Okay, so you're reducing by a factor of two. Dividing the existing congestion window by two, which is a multiplicative decrease, whereas increasing each time by one maximum segment size for every RTT is sort of an additive increase. Okay, so the increase is linear, whereas decrease is multiplicative. So therefore, this steady state approach, steady state congestion avoidance approach in TCP, it's called AIMD, or additive increase multiplicative decrease mechanism. Okay. So let's look at a bit more detail into how these things come together. Okay, we have something called congestion window. This is a field, just like the receive window. We've seen receive window for flow control before. So similarly, we have congestion window here. And the congestion window limits the amount of data that you can send from the sender side. So this is basically the window size determination. And like I said last time, this window size is dynamically determined as opposed to what you will do in your assignment. Okay. So this dynamic window size is the maximum of what the receiver tells you about the window size it thinks you should use, and what the network-based congestion window that you are trying to estimate. Okay, there is no one to tell you here in terms of what the congestion window is. It's just you have to determine yourself, and you take the max of both, and or sort of min of both, and that is what your congestion window is. The sender side window sizes. Okay, sender side window size is the minimum of congestion window and the receive window that we have seen before. Okay, now how do we keep the pipe, the network pipe, fully utilized? We've seen that ideally it should be equal to the bandwidth delay product. Okay, so how much ever the network bandwidth is, you multiply that by the round trip time, and then that gives you the bandwidth delay product, and that should be the amount of data that you should send to keep the network busy. Okay, So that is what is shown here. You can sort of rearrange it to get this sort of a thing where rate in this context corresponds to your throughput or goodput. Okay. So if you set it right, if you set the condition window to the optimal value, then essentially the rate is maximized. Okay. And that is what you want. I mean, for each user, you want to maximize the rate. At the same time, across all users, you want to make sure there is fairness. So that those are typical networking goals. Now, I already alluded to the fact that TCP uses these loss events as indicators of congestion. So you have two types of loss events, so three dupacks and the timeout. And it has three mechanisms here. One is the AMD, which we have seen, which is basically when things settle down, it's the steady state behavior. And the slow start is when you're starting off, when you just have this connection established and you're starting to send data. At that time, you use the slow start. But slow start in certain variants of TCP is also used later on as well, as we'll see. And this one is basically related to the slow start. So basically, you don't treat all loss events as the same. The timeout event is seen as a more serious event compared to the dupack because you know you have some data flowing back, which indicates that there is room in the network. Okay, so basically the first one is a little bit less worrisome event, whereas the second event, because you don't receive anything from the receiver, you have to get concerned and then basically take more serious measures to get around the perceived congestion. The slow start mechanism, like I said, it is something that is used at the beginning when you're starting off, and that's the reason why it's called slow start. But actually, if you look at it, compared to the other elements of TCP, it is actually quite a fast start. Okay, because you try to increase your rate exponentially in this phase. You're trying to ramp up. Okay, so you start with just one maximum segment size as your window size. Okay. The congestion window is set to one maximum segment size. Regardless of what the receiver says, that is going to limit your sender window because you're taking the minimum of both. Okay? The sender can send only one maximum segment, which is basically equal to the stop and wait. Right? So when you have one window size equals to one packet. Okay? And you start from there. When you receive an acknowledgement, you try to increase your window size by one. For every acknowledgement, you're going to increase this thing by one. What that means is, in a round trip time, if you have sent k packets and you get k acknowledgements, you go from k, congestion window equals k, to 2k. Because for every acknowledgement, you're increasing your congestion window by one. So essentially, for every round trip time, you're doubling your congestion window. And you do that until you hit a loss, meaning acknowledgments stop flowing back, and then you time out, or you know the duplicate acknowledgments comes in. So basically, you do this until you know pretty much network cannot handle any more of your ramping up. Okay, so that's the slow start phase in TCP. Now, we have to combine these things together so that you know they sort of become a protocol which actually behaves in a consistent way. So the separation between the timeout events and the dupack events, and also the separation between the slow start behavior and the additive increase, multiplicative decrease behavior, needs to be somehow put together. And the trick that is used in TCP is you use some sort of a threshold called slow start threshold. Okay, that is again dynamically varied. So I think these are easier if I just show you a picture. Okay, so let's focus on this blue curve, which is called TCP Tahoe, which is the original version of TCP. It's not the first version of TCP, but this is something that is the original stable version of TCP that's used since the late 80s. Okay, And then after that, there were refinements like the Renault, Vegas, and a number of others. Okay, so but let's focus on the blue curve. So the part that is called slow start is shown here. Okay, so when you're just starting off, when you have just the connection established and then you're sending, the loss event is the one that actually is going to stop you from the slow start. Okay, so this is later on, okay, when things settle down. Okay, so when a loss event happens, if you keep receiving duplicate acknowledgements, then you do not differentiate that from the timeout events in the original version. So basically in this version, doesn't matter whether it is slow start or, whether it is timeout or duplicate acknowledgements. In both cases, you're going to treat them the same. So whenever a loss event happens, you're going to bring the condition window from whatever the value it is to one maximum segment size. Basically, it's as if you're starting off again, okay? So imagine that before this point, that sort of a thing happened, okay? So, and then you brought your condition window right down to one maximum segment size. Now, till what point do you exponentially increase using slow start? So that's the question. And for that, you have a variable called slow start threshold, okay? So this slow start threshold, when this event happened, previous event where a loss was detected, whatever the condition window size was at that point, you cut that by half, okay? And that becomes your new slow start threshold. So in this case, given that it is 8 at this point, what that means is previously your condition window was 16 when the loss event happened. So that you brought the threshold down by half, and then you're going to exponentially increase till you reach the threshold, and after that you linearly increase. This linear increase is basically the additive increase, multiplicative decrease part of it, okay? So when a loss happens again, at this point, because you're dropping, essentially means that, you're not getting acknowledgements back, or you're getting duplicate acknowledgements, but not the new acknowledgements. So therefore, what you do in the original version is you take a drastic measure. You really don't care what the loss type is. You just go back to one maximum segment size. Okay. And the window size here is 12. So the slow start threshold, the new slow start threshold becomes half of that, which is 6, and you start all over again. You start increasing till the slow start threshold exponentially, and then beyond that, linearly. And then whenever a loss happens, you repeat. So basically, if you focus on this part, which is very similar to what we have seen here, okay? But this is not the original version that is shown here, okay? So this is the refined version, which has fast recovery mechanism, and that is called the TCP Reno, okay? This blue line. So the TCP Reno and TCP Tahoe, they are different in the sense that whenever you detect the loss because of 3 duplicate acknowledgments, you do not reduce your condition window to one maximum segment size, but you set it to the same value as what you set the slow start threshold. It's as if you bypass the step. Okay, so you get it down to the level, basically you reduce the condition window by half and then start growing linearly again. Okay, so if you just look at this scenario, so if you join these dots, what you have is the sawtooth waveform. Okay, if you only have these loss events because of dupacs, and that is basically the steady state behavior, then you will never enter the slow start after the initial part. Okay, the slow start is only used when you first establish the connection. And after that, it is basically you linearly increase, multiplicative decrease, linearly increase, multiplicatively decrease, linearly increase, and so forth. So that's your classical sawtooth waveform, okay? So in terms of the details, I think, you know, basically, I'm not going to go through the various steps, but it is worth looking at the state diagram for TCP. What I would indicate is a couple of things. One is there are many seemingly arbitrary choices in terms of how, for instance, the condition window is set at certain points. Like, for instance, when you have the duplicate acknowledgments equals 3, when you retransmit your segment, the condition window is set to something called SS threshold plus 3. Okay, so these are engineering choices. There is no solid reason for that. I mean, they are reasonable, given that, you know, you had 3 acknowledgments that were flowing back, so basically there is enough capacity for 3 already. So in a way, you use that as an inference to set that, and you start from there. So those.